So today we're doing a deep dive into something I think is just, it's fundamental. It's that sheer crushing stress of disappointment. You know, when life just refuses to cooperate with your plans. We're actually tackling a request from a listener on this, someone looking for real tools to manage that anxiety when expectations, well, when they fail.
And they fail spectacularly
They
sometimes.
do. And I think the perfect hook for this, it comes right from the source material we looked at. Think about Clark Griswold in Christmas Vacation.
Oh, yes, the classic,
Right?
y'all.
He has this one goal, the perfect Christmas. And every single little snag, the lights, the turkey, the family, it doesn't just ruin a moment. It causes
Yeah.
this volcanic eruption of
We've
stress.
all been there. Maybe not quite at that level.
Maybe not. But that feeling of chaos when your vision just collapses, that anxiety is what we're targeting today.
And what's so fascinating is that this isn't a new problem. The sources we're analyzing tackle this exact emotional strain, but through an ancient theological lens. We've been looking at a specific commentary on the Gospel of John. Specifically, it's chapter 12, verses 36 to 43. And our whole mission here is to pull out this framework it offers for finding peace, even when everything feels like it's failing.
And the central question John was dealing with back then is, I mean, it's surprisingly relevant to our own anxieties about failure. He's asking, why didn't people believe in Jesus? He did all these incredible things, so why the failure?
Exactly. And the commentary gives us three key insights from that passage that can really give us some stability when our own lives feel chaotic.
All right, so let's set the scene for this analysis. This passage, it marks a real turning point. It's the end of Jesus' public ministry to the crowds.
Right. He's delivered his final teachings.
And because the crowds didn't respond the way you'd expect, he leaves and hides himself from them. It's a moment of really profound public disappointment.
And that failure of expectation is really the engine driving John's commentary. We have to remember, he wrote this gospel way later, maybe 90 or 95 AD, so 60 years after the events.
Wow, okay.
And his audience, the early church, they were struggling with this big question. If Jesus did all these world-changing things, why is there still so much unbelief? It felt like the mission wasn't finished.
And John is so meticulous about the evidence he presents. He says, and I'm quoting here, though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe. He's not just saying Jesus did a few nice things.
No, not at all. He's pointing to these huge, public, unforgettable demonstrations of power.
And the source material lists them out so clearly. There were seven big ones, right?
Yes. And they're not random. Think about it. Turning water into wine.
Power over the physical world.
Healing a royal official's son, a paralyzed man, a man born blind.
So power over disease, over suffering.
Exactly. Then you have feeding the 5,000 and walking on water.
Control over nature itself.
And then, of course, the biggest one of all.
Raising Lazarus from the dead.
I mean, if you connect all these dots, John is making this profound argument. The signs showed power over life, death, disease, material world. So if raising a man who'd been dead for 4 days wasn't enough to convince people.
Then the problem isn't a lack of evidence.
Exactly. It's not a data deficit. John's pointing to something deeper, a crisis of will, maybe, or pride. So the question for us is, when our plans fail, and we've done all the signs, put in all the work, and we still come up short, is the failure really external? Or is it something in how we perceive control?
So John sees the world as chaotic, it's disappointing. He needs a framework for internal peace that doesn't depend on external success. And that, I guess, brings us to the first pillar of stability. Okay, so let's unpack this first solution, finding peace when expectations fail. John's first move is to shift the focus from the failure of people to the consistency of God. The commentary calls this trusting in the sovereign plan.
That's the one. The idea that God is in complete control, even when things feel completely out of
It's a
control.
big concept.
It is. And to process that disappointment, John doesn't invent some new idea. He goes back to scripture. He quotes the prophet Isaiah.
Isaiah 53, right?
Yep. And he shows his audience that the failure of the crowds to believe, it wasn't messing up God's plan, it was actually fulfilling it.
Wait, so the failure was part of the plan.
That's what he's arguing. The goal wasn't necessarily for everyone to accept Jesus right then and there. The goal was divine fulfillment. The disappointing outcome was, in a way, written into the script.
And that's where it gets so practical for us when we're in that Clark Griswold moment. Isaiah 53 describes the Messiah not as this adored hero, but as a suffering servant, someone who would be crushed for our iniquities.
Right. So if the entire crowd had loved him, if the mission had been a huge success from a human point of view,
he never would have gone to the cross. The whole plan would have been different.
Exactly. The judgment against him by the high priest, by the Pharisees, it all looks like this ultimate human failure, but John shows it was necessary. That failure was required for the purpose to be met.
That is a massive reframing tool. When you get laid off or a business fails, you see it as a complete disaster, a deviation from the plan.
Of course.
But this suggests that understanding there might be a why behind it, a purpose in the disappointment that can bring peace, even if the situation itself doesn't immediately change.
It shifts you from panic to perspective. And the source material had some really practical steps for this. It's about moving from just, you know, theoretically surrendering to actually doing it.
Okay, like what?
Well, first, stop trusting interpretations based only on your feelings. Feelings are, you know, they're erratic. Instead, look for past patterns of provision. Remind yourself that sometimes bad things do lead to good.
And the other steps were really grounded. Praying genuinely with a heart that's actually willing to surrender control. And the big one, lean on your community.
Don't isolate.
Right. Sharing those burdens, those failures.
Yeah.
It prevents that isolation that just makes stress 100 times worse.
Mm-hmm. When you surrender control to a bigger plan, you find resources outside of yourself.
So, if the first key is accepting the sovereign plan, how does that move from just an intellectual idea to, you know, actual felt peace? Acceptance of chaos can only get you so far.
That's the perfect question, because once you accept the scale of the plan, you have to shift your perspective to the scale of the planner, and that's the second key. Beholding the glory of Christ.
Which the source is defined as grasping the bigness of God.
That's it. It's the ultimate zoom out button.
And John connects this back to that incredible vision Isaiah had in chapter 6.
He does. It's one of the most vivid moments in the entire Bible. Isaiah gets this vision of God's pre-incarnate glory. He sees the Lord on a throne, high and lifted up. The temple is filled with smoke. With his robe.
And there are seraphim, these celestial beings.
Flying around, calling out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory."
The power of that vision is in Isaiah's response. Hmm. He isn't thinking about his problems, his to-do list, his unmet expectations. He just declares, "Woe is me, for I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips."
He instantly sees his own smallness, his failures, next to the absolute overwhelming scale of God.
And this is the context for that amazing analogy we found, the story of the hiker in the mountain.
Oh, this one is so good. So imagine a hiker starts out on a perfect clear day. Halfway up the mountain, a violent storm just rolls in out of nowhere.
Total chaos. Rain, wind, lightning.
Right. And the hiker feels small, vulnerable, totally overwhelmed by it all. They panic. They're reacting to the chaos around them.
That hiker is us. When we lose a job, get a bad diagnosis, or watch our perfect Christmas vision just crumble, we react to the immediate chaos.
But here's the realization the hiker eventually has. The mountain itself, it's stable. It's unmoved. It is completely unchanged by the storm. It didn't tremble. It wasn't thrown into confusion.
It just stood there.
Exactly where it had always stood, no matter how scared the hiker was or how violent the storm became.
The analogy being that God is infinitely more stable than that mountain.
Infinitely. He's not panicked when we're panicked. His nature doesn't suddenly change because our expected outcome failed.
So his stability is the source of our safety and peace.
Right. Our anxiety shrinks because the problem, when you see it against the backdrop of the mountain, suddenly looks its actual size, not the size of our fear.
Which brings us to the final key from John's commentary. And this one feels very internal, about integrity.
It is.
Living for God's approval, not man's.
Yes. John points out in verse 42 that the unbelief wasn't actually total. Many of the authorities, the leaders, they did believe in Jesus.
But they kept it a secret.
They kept it a secret. They refused to confess their faith publicly.
And the reason why reveals this really deep internal division. They were terrified of the Pharisees. They were afraid of being put out of the synagogue.
Which was a huge deal. It meant losing their reputation, their status, their entire standing in the community. That external human glory was just too much to risk.
And John's judgment on that is so stark. He says they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God.
It wasn't about theology at that point. It was about fear and reputation. Their whole focus was on human perception, not on aligning their actions with what they actually believed.
This speaks so directly to the stress of disappointment. When our expectations and our anxiety are all tied up in human metrics, our boss's approval, what our peers think, we're so vulnerable.
You're chasing a moving target.
Yeah. And the source makes the point that you can't have peace if you are divided amongst yourself, believing one thing on the inside, but living a contradiction on the outside.
That internal division is devastating to peace. Integrity really means wholeness here. You're one person. Your private belief aligns with your public action. If you're constantly fighting that internal conflict, you're guaranteed to lose your stability.
So if we bring it all back to the beginning, it's not just the external chaos, like the failed Christmas lights, that robs us of peace. It's this internal chaos, too.
Absolutely. John is arguing that you have to follow your convictions publicly, no matter the cost to your human status, because that's what's required for the wholeness that maintains peace.
It's choosing internal stability over external validation.
And when your worth isn't tied to the fleeting glory of what other people think, the failure of your expectations becomes a lot less catastrophic.
So this deep dive really gives us a solid three-pillared structure for dealing with disappointment. Wow. It's not about trying to control things harder. It's about shifting your entire perspective.
Mm-hmm. Trusting the sovereign plan, beholding the infinite glory of Christ.
And anchoring your life to God's approval, not man's.
And we learned that for John's audience, that initial failure, the fact that people didn't believe, was actually predicted. It was necessary to fulfill a greater plan. It led to something tragic, the cross, but ultimately to universal good.
Right.
So that brings up a really interesting question for you, the listener, to think about. What situation in your own life right now feels tragic or stressful or just deeply disappointing? A financial problem, a career dead end.
A painful argument.
Whatever it is. Could that situation, viewed through the lens of history or a much larger unseen plan, ultimately be seen as necessary? Or even somehow for the good, something needed for a greater fulfillment down the line?
That is some food for thought. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into stability and expectation. We really hope these insights help you find your peace.